WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the burning of black churches. We talk with Reverend Dennis Lawson of the Canaan AME Church in Columbia, Tennessee. His church was firebombed last year. He'll tell us about the lasting impact on the church and the community. Also, growing up the daughter of a baseball and civil rights legend, we talk with Sharon Robinson. Her father was Jackie Robinson. She was born 5 years after he broke baseball's color barrier. She's written a family memoir called Stealing Home. And Milo Miles reviews a new rap record from Senegal. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. President Clinton is challenging world leaders at the economic summit in France to face down what he called the new threats to our freedom. Mr. Clinton said we must rally the forces of tolerance everywhere to work against terrorism. The president said there would likely have been even more casualties from the explosion in Saudi Arabia had it not been for the increased security measures which took effect at the base last fall. But Mr. Clinton went on to say the bomb was just bigger than anyone calculated could be gotten that close to the building. The bodies of the 19 Americans killed in the blast are scheduled to be arriving at Dover Air Force Base in Delaware at this hour. Some of the Americans who were injured are being transferred to an Air Force military hospital in Germany, as NPR's Deidre Berger reports.
Air Force personnel expect 60 of the injured to be brought to the Air Force Hospital at Landstuhl, southwest of Frankfurt. An Air Force spokesman says at least 15 people are seriously injured. Others will be treated for broken bones and burns. An Air Force medical evacuation squadron of about 25 people flew yesterday from Germany to Saudi Arabia. They will accompany the injured in the plane arriving at Ramstein Air Base in Germany. The Air Force has also sent a stress management team to Saudi Arabia to help victims of the bombing cope with the psychological impact. President Clinton will depart early from a G7 economic summit in France to attend memorial services in Florida on Sunday for some of the military personnel killed in the bombing. I'm Deidre Berger in Frankfurt.
The Senate has unanimously passed sweeping legislation that would allow the military to help local police and fire departments in the event of a terrorist attack in the United States. Under the measure, military forces could lend support in cases of a chemical, biological, or nuclear attack. Russia's new security chief, Alexander Lebed, has released a document outlining his concept for national security. NPR's Ann Garrels reports.
Although he is no economist, retired General Alexander Lebed's concept of national security is closely linked to issues like capital flight, economic crime, protection of Russia's raw materials, and support for domestic industry. The document published by Interfax is a sweeping overview, but it nonetheless points to tougher controls and a bigger role for the state. Lebed suggests the Russian privatization process be slowed. He pledges to tighten Russia's passport and visa regulations for foreigners. He warns against persistent use of loans from international financial organizations, saying the International Monetary Fund could one sunny day determine this debt spiral was unacceptable. According to Lebed, the end of such financing would lead to a crisis in Russia's financial system. I'm Ann Garrels in Moscow.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down about 26 points, but the Nasdaq Composite Index is up 4.5. This is NPR News. Government experts are inspecting the fire damage at the Treasury Department building next to the White House. The roof of the 150-year-old structure caught fire yesterday afternoon. The blaze is believed to have been triggered by some restoration work being done in the roof area. Women's activists picketed the annual shareholders meeting of Mitsubishi Corporation in Tokyo today, expressing hope for progress in settling the sexual harassment lawsuit filed against the Japanese firm. NPR's Julie McCarthy reports.
The U.S. Equal Employment Opportunity Commission has charged Mitsubishi Motor Manufacturing of America with creating a hostile and abusive work environment at its plant in Normal, Illinois. Representatives of women's groups from both the U.S. and Japan demonstrated outside the stockholders' meeting in an attempt to publicize the problem of sexual harassment. Sex discrimination is rampant among Japanese companies, and being called to account for it is extremely rare. The shareholders who filed past the protesters are unaccustomed to such dissent. But with the potential of 500 plaintiffs in a class action and damages of $150 million, the company announced this week it will recommend ways to improve the work environment for women by mid-July. In Tokyo, this is Julie McCarthy.
Play is the work assignment today for some of the astronauts aboard the space shuttle Columbia. They're testing their hand-eye coordination and memory by playing special video games on a laptop computer. In addition to their medical experiments, the astronauts videotape shots of smoke and haze from the wildfires burning north of the Grand Canyon. Fires have charred over 60,000 acres in Arizona over the past week. Firefighters in Nevada are hoping to have a blaze that's burning near Lake Tahoe fully contained late today. In addition to the flames, the firefighters are having to contend with heavy rain, hail, snow, and lightning. I'm Craig Windham, National Public Radio News in Washington.
Support for Fresh Air comes from Farrar, Straus & Giroux, publishers of Lush Life, a new biography about jazz legend Billy Strayhorn. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Many black churches have been under attack. According to the Center for Democratic Renewal, 80 mostly rural, historically black, and multiracial churches have been firebombed, burned, or vandalized since January of 1990. 28 of those attacks occurred since January of this year. My guest, Reverend Dennis Lawson, is the pastor of a small church in Columbia, Tennessee, that was firebombed in January of 1995. The Canaan AME Church has a congregation of about 100 people in a rural area of Tennessee that is about 25% African American. Reverend Lawson lives in Nashville, which is about an hour from Columbia. Yesterday he was in Washington to attend a breakfast with President Clinton on the burning of black churches. After the breakfast, I spoke with Reverend Lawson about the impact of the firebombing on his community. First, I asked him to describe what happened.
My church was one of three two churches and a tavern that was firebombed on that evening. It started out, there were three gentlemen who did the firebombing, adult males, who started with a tavern. And from the tavern, they traveled approximately 15 miles to the Friendship Baptist Church, where they erected a cross and started it to burn and then hurled Molotov cocktails into the main sanctuary of the church. And from there, they traveled approximately another 15 miles to my church, in which they did the same thing, erected the cross and hurled the Molotov cocktails into the building. Fortunately for my congregation, the firebombs entered through the lower auditorium of the building, and while it destroyed much of the kitchen area, it did not destroy the main sanctuary of the church, the main church offices, and so have you. But there was quite a bit of damage done to the lower auditorium in the kitchen area. But the amazing thing in our situation is that once the flames intensified, they managed to either melt or cause the water lines to erupt, and the flames were distinguished. I think of it as, the angels of Satan starting the fire, and before the bottles were hurled, God has dispatched his own band of firefighters to handle the situation. So while we did have damage done to the building, it wasn't the type of damage that we've seen in many of the churches in which they lost everything.
Have you been able to use the church?
Yes. It did not prevent us from, carrying on weekly services like we normally do. It did prevent us for 2 to 3 months from using the kitchen area until it had been repaired, and so have you. But the rest of the building was usable.
Now, you say that a cross was erected outside of the church.
Yes.
Just before it was firebombed. Mm-hmm. Does that mean that the people who were the arsonists were members of the Ku Klux Klan?
We can't say. And in repeating what the FBI and the state attorney general and district attorney stated, that they believe that the three were, in their terms, were too dumb to be a part of an organized group. They believe that these individuals acted just among themselves. So we can't say that it was the Ku Klux Klan or any other group. We do know that there were some very racial explicit materials circulated through the mail to the local fire marshal. However, we were not privy to that information because the courts felt that it was so derogatory that it could cause quite a bit of confusion if the contents of that letter was released. But we do know, and the three have admitted that in their case, it was simple racism.
Have they stood trial yet?
They pleaded guilty. So they avoided trial, but they have been sentenced, and they are now serving federal time.
Mm-hmm. What was your reaction when you found out that your church had been firebombed?
Devastated. As a matter of fact, members of my congregation did not know the church had been firebombed because the water system had put the fire out. They were consoling members of the Friendship Baptist Church at the time, only to discover hours later that the church had been firebombed. But it was quite devastating. And for the first few days, there was quite a bit of alarm, quite a bit of fear. We did not know if I was a target or any particular individual within the congregation was a target. Therefore, it meant that I had to have traveling companions because the city of Columbia is approximately an hour drive from Nashville. It meant that someone had to be with me for the first few days, that I would have to notify individuals in Nashville when I left Nashville, when I arrived in Columbia, and when I left Columbia and to return. It caused quite a bit of fear within our children. I service a small congregation, but 50% of the congregation are children. So we had to be particularly concerned about the children. My son in particularly, like others, were having problems sleeping. If I was out of the house, he just could not be content until he knew that I had safely returned. And that fear was throughout the congregation where the children were concerned.
Do you have any new security measures that you're using either at your church or personal security measures?
Yes. We were forced to have to install electronic alarms. Now, we've got a system in place now that if there is even window breakage, the alarms will automatically sound if there's fire damage or anything. Also, for me personally, it meant that I had to go out and purchase a cell phone and so have you. So I have to keep that with me at all times so that I can keep, you know, communication with others as I move around.
Mm-hmm.
There have been, you know, some little strange things occurring, and I can't say that it's connected or not. For instance, oftentimes I'm finding that my car has been keyed, and, you know, new scratches are appearing constantly. And again, I don't know if it's connected, but we do have to take certain precautions.
Do you look at the attack on your church as an isolated incident, you know, three stupid, hate-filled people attacking the church? Or do you see it as a part of a larger pattern of hatred in your community now?
Well, I think it's a pattern in terms of hatred, not necessarily isolated to that community, but across the nation. There is no positive proof that there's any type of organized conspiracy. However, there are those of us believe that there could exist perhaps a loose conspiracy of of sense. We know that there have been certain patterns that have been followed in several of these firebombing. They're generally done late at night, usually between the hours of 11 and 2 to 3 a.m. They're done under the cover of darkness. The churches have pretty much all been located in remote areas, extremely rural areas where you have to know where they are to know that they are there. It's not a situation where you can just randomly come upon these places. You've got to pretty much know where you are. In many of the incidents, we've seen 3 to 4 burnings at a time, all within hours of each other in the same communities. So whether there is a conspiracy or not, we do know that there are many, many similarities.
Reverend, would you describe your church and the community that it serves?
Well, my church, it's a small congregation in number. However, it's a great church in terms of its heart and the spirit of the church. It's large from a spiritual aspect. And I think the flavor that is represented within my congregation is something that's felt throughout the entire community in which these churches are located. As a fact, the entire county stood steadfast and supported us, both congregations, when this occurred. And they made it clear to people in that community, we are embarrassed by these acts, and we will not allow such things to take place in this community. And they showed their concerns by the manner in which they came to our aid, with the Friendship Baptist Church sustaining the greater amount of damage, and it was done to their main sanctuary. The community across racial lines and ethnic backgrounds all came together and worked 24 hours a day, starting immediately to refurbish and to repair the damage that was done. This occurred on a Sunday evening, late Sunday evening, and by Sunday morning of the next week, they were back in the sanctuary because the community just worked around the clock to do it.
How quickly were the three suspects apprehended?
They were apprehended approximately 4 to 5 days after the firebombings occurred.
How do you feel the firebombing of your church has been dealt with by the FBI and by local law enforcement officials?
Well, in our case, I feel very good about the way that they dealt with us. I know that there are those who feel that they themselves are being targeted and they're being treated unfairly in these investigations. But I cannot say that that occurred in our situation. I thought that the FBI and the local law enforcement made a tremendous effort to be of assistance to us. There was never any intimidation or anything of that nature. And I don't know if that was because the arrests were made so quickly or not, but their support was tremendous.
So you're pleased with the way things have gone in your case?
Yes.
My guest is Reverend Dennis Lawson. His church was firebombed in January of 1995. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Reverend Dennis Lawson. He's the pastor of a church in rural Tennessee that was firebombed last year. Now, you came of age during the Civil Rights Movement?
Yes.
Where did you grow up?
Roxboro, North Carolina, a little city outside of Durham.
Mm-hmm. And do you remember there being any attacks on churches when you were young?
Well, I remember, you know, watching television and seeing the bombings in Alabama and so have you. I was a product of integration. I was placed in an all-white school before the integration laws of the 60s were even passed. So I lived much of what a number of people have witnessed on TV when, you know, they saw the integration of schools in Arkansas and Mississippi and other areas. I lived that. But even living that and watching the firebombs that occurred in the 60s as a child did little to prepare me for what happened a year and a half ago. It was just unthinkable that something like that would occur today, but as we see, it did.
What impact did it have on you as a child when you heard, for instance, about the bombing of the church in Birmingham, in which four 14-year-old girls were killed?
Well, it was very frightful, period, for me as a child, because as we know, during the 60s, many of the pastors of churches were targeted, and I grew up in a pastor's household, a family of ministers, so there was always a threat hanging over the household. I can remember the adults going armed and so have you when they traveled because of this, and to top it off, having been placed in a non-integrated school didn't help matters, but there were things that we had to do, and, you know, I just happened to be part of that environment at the time. But it's quite interesting because in the 70s, as a college student, I had the opportunity to go to school, undergraduate school, with the brother of one of those four young girls that were killed in Birmingham in 63.
Wow.
And even at that time, you could still see the pain and the hurt in him that of the manner in which his sister had died. And even at that, it still would not occur to me that years later, I would be faced with the same situation again. As a matter of fact, approximately 6 weeks before the firebombing occurred, my family and I were in Birmingham, Alabama, in which we had the opportunity to tour the Civil Rights Museum there. And there we saw the buses that had been firebombed and so have you during the 60s on display. And still, you know, after seeing all of this, it just does not prepare you when it occurs.
Did the Civil Rights Movement have anything to do with you becoming a pastor?
No. I guess in my case, I was told from the day of my birth that I would eventually be a minister. As a matter of fact, it's the one thing I wanted less to do with. But as we see, it's the one thing that I've had to do. It's one of those things that it's hard to explain unless you've actually had to deal with it and go through it yourself. I've always heard ministers talk about that special calling that they received, and you would wonder about, have these people lost their minds or what have you? But I know now that it's very true, but it's one of those things that you can't really explain to those who've not experienced it. I can say that had I remained in North Carolina in the environment I grew up in, it's a real possibility that I could have gone into the ministry never knowing that I was actually intended to do so. But with me leaving home, going to Nashville to school, and having a time to be away from that environment for a while assured me that what was going on with me was very real.
So it sounds like you were called both by God and family.
Oh, yes.
What have your sermons been like since the church was bombed?
From the pulpit, we've tried to teach positivism and to look for the positive aspects in life. We do realize that there's pain all around, and we deal with that pain. But we teach the people that if you really look through or try to see yourself through the pain, then you will realize that you've got something to rejoice for. It has been difficult, I will say, to prepare sermons and to meditate and study as I need to during this period, because this has so occupied much of my time for the last year and a half. So it's been somewhat difficult to prepare sermons, but again, if one has been truly called to do this type of service, and that individual use the talents that he or she has been given by God, then they can make a way to do things. As a matter of fact, one of the things that has helped me the most is I work out. I try to work out in the health club 2 to 3 times a week on an average. And that has helped tremendously, because instead of displaying anger and frustration publicly, I can go to the gym and, you know, run 3 or 4 miles and lift some weights and so have you. So the physical exercise has really worked hand in hand with the ministry as of late.
That's very interesting. Has your church been rebuilt, the parts that were destroyed, the kitchen?
Yes, we were able to make the repairs. And as a matter of fact, most of the repairs were completed within 3 to 4 months after the firebombing.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Okay. And if I may just make one statement.
Please.
I don't know who can hear this broadcast or who will hear this broadcast, but we do want to make it very clear to those individuals who may take it upon themselves to do these types of crimes that while they may destroy buildings, they cannot destroy the church, because the church is within the people. And out of the ruins of ashes, we're seeing new temples and new churches springing up. So I think they need to know crystal clearly that they cannot destroy God's church.
Dennis Lawson is the pastor of the Canaan AME Church in Columbia, Tennessee. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard, and from Penguin Books, publisher of Penguin Classics, for 50 years the definition of classic. Penguin Classics catalog available through email at reading@penguin.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Sharon Robinson wasn't yet born when her father, Jackie Robinson, broke baseball's color barrier. When she was a girl, her family protected her from hearing about the struggles he went through to integrate the major league. Coming up, we meet Sharon Robinson. She's written a family memoir. And Milo Miles reviews a new rap record from Senegal. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Just about everyone in America knew what Jackie Robinson went through to integrate Major League Baseball. His daughter Sharon Robinson says that by the time she was born, the major trauma of his first few years in baseball was behind him. She didn't grow up hearing horror stories of her father's pioneering efforts. He retired from Major League Baseball when she was six. That year, at summer camp, she saw a movie called The Jackie Robinson Story. It was filmed the year she was born, 1950. Well, there she was, the only black girl in a group of 80 campers, watching a movie that revealed the horrors her parents hadn't told her about. This is the kind of anecdote Sharon Robinson tells in her new family memoir, Stealing Home. Sharon Robinson is a nurse midwife in a community hospital. She lives in Connecticut. I asked her if the experience of seeing the Jackie Robinson story when she was six changed her sense of her father.
It changed my sense of my father, and it also changed the sense of my community, because I was living in an all-white community and attending a school where I was the only black child. So it made me wonder how this gets transferred into my life.
And what did it make you think about in terms of that?
It made me realize that my world may not be as I saw it, and that I was different, and that people would, were seeing me differently.
When you were very young, your parents moved to a white suburban neighborhood. Your parents very much wanted the best for you and wanted the children to have everything they didn't have. How did you feel, though, about being the only African-American family in the neighborhood and in the school?
Well, Terry, I loved my neighborhood as a child. I have wonderful memories. I had a great friend down the street, and my brothers and I had good friendships, and we had fun as children. It was school that caused more concern for me. The kids did ask me questions like, did I bathe? Why was the color of my skin different on the inner surface of my hands? Those kinds of questions made me feel different, as I was saying, and I found myself reacting to that by just getting shyer and shyer, and I was very quiet in class and, not causing any other attention to myself.
You write that your parents wanted to retain ties to the black community even though they'd moved into a white neighborhood. How did they go about doing that?
Yeah, that's very important to them. My father did it by bringing the civil rights movement right to our dinner table and talking about the children in the South that were integrating their schools, and talking about what was happening with the other activists in the South. My mother worked very hard at finding us other black friends, and we joined an organization that was for middle-class black children, and that was also, she saw, as very important to us to maintain those ties.
What was the organization?
Jack and Jill. It's a social organization. It still exists.
And how did you like it?
Terry, it was, I can look back on it and say it was an important phase of my life. At times I felt it was exclusionary, and I resented that, and I fought against some of its own exclusionary practices.
Because it was so middle class?
So middle class. And if you weren't a doctor or lawyer, or your father wasn't a doctor or lawyer, or someone famous, you weren't necessarily invited to join Jack and Jill. And I realized that most when I went to high school, and I wanted to invite some of my friends from Stanford High, and I was told that couldn't be invited. They didn't live in the right neighborhoods, didn't have the right background, and they weren't part of the Jack and Jill group.
I'm wondering if, in spite of your father's importance in the civil rights movement, if you felt very cut off by all of that, by virtue of being, kind of upper middle class at this point and living in a pretty exclusive neighborhood.
It was a struggle for me to figure out where I fit in at that point in my life. I was isolated from a black community and not really part of this white community that I was living in. It wasn't actually until I went to, I think that's why Howard University became so important to me, because it was for the first time, I was in this huge community surrounded by African Americans and the teachers, the student body, and they were going out in all walks of life and from all parts of the country, all parts of the world, actually, Terry. And it was really important to my self-esteem for me to see this and be a part of this community.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Sharon Robinson, and she's written a memoir called Stealing Home, a family portrait by the daughter of Jackie Robinson. Your father had a trophy room that was, just all of his trophies, and I'm sure there were lots of them. How did that make you feel? Was there a mingling of kind of pride and insecurity?
I think that's how you would put it. The trophy room was, actually the room was just, we had to enter the room on our way to the playroom. So we saw it every single day when we went down to our game room. And the room was a wonderful room. It had his plaques and his baseball bats, and it had balls, and it had his football, bronze football shoe. And I had, lots of favorites, and I was very proud of it. I mean, they had all kinds of words. I could see that he went beyond baseball. He talked about brotherhood and humanitarianism and activism. And all of those were wonderful to me until we started entering adolescence, naturally in adolescence, you're trying to figure out who you are and where your talents are. And I hadn't discovered that yet. And I think it was the same thing was true of my brother, Jackie. We were kind of average kids. We got pretty much C averages in school, and I was an all-around athlete, but I had nothing that I was particularly great in. And I didn't know what I wanted to be. I thought I would be a social worker or a nurse when I grew up, but I really hadn't found myself. So as adolescence hit, that wonderful room became anxiety-producing.
After your father retired from baseball, he stayed active in the civil rights movement, in the NAACP, but he came out for Richard Nixon during the presidential campaign, Nixon versus Kennedy. And then some people started calling him an Uncle Tom. How did you react to that?
It was very painful for me. It's one thing, I was also somewhat critical of my father's politics or concerned about my father's politics as he entered, became supported more of the Republican candidates, and I thought he was getting more conservative. But that was okay for me to question him or to feel, but when it came from the outside, I was very defensive of him. I remember particularly when my cousin Chucky called and said that my father was an Uncle Tom, and I just, felt really angry and wanted to defend him, but I couldn't because I wasn't sure if he was one or not myself. So I had a discussion with my father, and I decided I couldn't ask him if he was an Uncle Tom, but I could ask him if he was a Republican, and I decided that would be my determining factor. And his answer confused me even more because what he said was, I'm neither a Republican nor a Democrat. I am independent, but I do believe that we can't have, black people cannot all be in one party, that we have to be represented in both parties.
What other reasons did he give you for his support of Nixon?
Kennedy had not supported some of the civil rights acts, and then my father actually sat down face to face with John F. Kennedy, and he didn't look him in the eye. He couldn't give him any really. He didn't feel like he got straight answers on issues, and he felt that Nixon had supported some of the earlier civil rights acts, so he chose to go with Richard Nixon, and learned along the way that that was not the best decision, but he stuck with it until the end.
Did you continue to have problems with it?
Yes, I did. Oh, absolutely. I was certainly in my own politics. I was thinking more towards the revolutionaries, and I was young and didn't really understand politics thoroughly. But I was idolizing the more revolutionary leaders, and this was before Jesse Jackson gave us another alternative, which was the economic alternative. And then when that happened, my father was able to find someone he could support, and it also gave those of us who weren't quite, the revolutionary, and yet we weren't, with the conservative side of the organizations. It gave us an option.
Well, you write about one time when you had a picture of Huey Newton, Black Panther, on a wall of your room, I guess, and your father came in and said, take that down. Did you have a big fight about that? This is such a typical fight from the period.
Well, we didn't have a big fight because my father rarely refused me anything. And he came in that room and his voice was so forceful and his statement so clear that I didn't hesitate to take it down. I was angry with him for making me do that because it was my room and I felt I should be allowed to have whatever I wanted on my wall. But he made it clear that it was his house. And that's what reigned at that point.
My guest is Sharon Robinson. She's written a new family memoir called Stealing Home. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Sharon Robinson. She's the daughter of Jackie Robinson. I'm wondering if you, when you were growing up, if you were expected to be, quote, you know, a model of the race, if you were supposed to be like an example of a perfect young African American.
Well, I certainly felt that. We were, if you just look at some of the early photographs, we were always depicted as the perfect family. And I had parents that were quite perfect or quite wonderful, and certainly viewed as a sort of a, like a king and queen, you know, in the society. And it did add an additional burden on us to live up to that.
Even though there was, you know, a certain expectation that the children would be exemplary, your oldest brother, Jackie Robinson Jr., got into a lot of trouble. And I think this was particularly true when he got home from the Vietnam War. He'd started using drugs in Vietnam. He was dealing by the time he got home. How did your parents deal with that?
It was very, very hard for my parents. It was hard because I couldn't reach him, and they felt like they had no control of the situation. They had lost their son. But they remained. I think the important part was that they stayed by him. They when Jackie would disappear for a while, my father or my mother would go out looking for him, and when that didn't work, they would send me out. And Jackie would never let us find him, but he would make contact with us within 24 hours because we certainly knew all of his hiding places or his hangouts. So someone would get the word to him that we were looking for him and we were worried. He purposely stayed away from the house, I think, so that he wouldn't expose us to his drug use. So it was although we knew something was wrong and we were very worried about him, we didn't exactly accept the fact that it might be drugs or it might be heroin. I mean, the worst of all drugs. So it was quite a shock when he was arrested.
You describe a scene in your memoir in which you went with your father to a speaking engagement, and at the speaking engagement, he talked about his feelings about Jackie Jr. Could you describe what he said?
Yeah, he talked about how drugs can be a great leveler in society, and that once it publicly moved out of the black communities and into middle-class communities, it became a larger issue for everyone. And that it was very hard on a family, not just on the individual that's using the drugs, but on the entire family. And he talked about how they had pulled together and stuck behind their son. And as a result of it, my brother eventually overcame the drug addiction. But it took a number of years, and it was quite painful for the family.
After your brother seemed to have overcome his drug addiction, he died. How did he die?
Well, he died in a car accident. He was coming home. He was working on a fundraiser for Daytop, which was a program he had actually graduated from.
A rehab program.
Rehab program. And a fundraiser was at our house. It was a jazz concert. And he died coming home. He was on his way home and died. He was actually driving my brother's car, my younger brother's car.
And was there any question about whether he was high when he was driving?
No question. Actually, they did test him, and there was no drugs or alcohol found in his bloodstream.
God, what a horrible thing that must have been. He finally kind of gets clean and then dies in an accident.
Yeah, it was horrible, and it was very hard to understand, you know, how that could happen, because he was just really beginning to live and make a contribution to many communities. And it was hard to understand, and I think it was Jesse Jackson that helped us to understand the importance of, you know, that it wasn't the birth and the death date that was important, but what happened in between, and Jackie had come full circle.
Your young adulthood got off to a rocky start, too. You married a man who had been abusing you. And you kept thinking, oh, it'll stop. You apologized. But it didn't stop. And you couldn't confide in your parents. Why couldn't you confide in your parents?
Well, a combination of things. You know, at that time, people didn't talk about physical abuse as they do now. I was an adolescent. Adolescents tend not to talk to their parents about, well, I mean, there are adolescents that do, but in our family, we did not talk about our feelings very much in general. And I was a quiet kid right from the beginning, and I, you know, never did express my feelings very much. And I didn't understand what kind of world I had entered on. And I thought that, I think the big part of a physical abuse relationship is the mental abuse, the emotional abuse, and you end up feeling like you in some way have done something wrong to deserve this. So you keep trying to make yourself better and try to make the situation better so that you won't be hit again. And it doesn't work. And I had to learn that. And it was, I think it was the shock of my brother being arrested that, you know, brought me into reality that I had truly lost control of my life.
And you left him?
Well, I said that he had beat me for the last time. That was my promise to myself. And the next time he hit me, I walked out of the house.
Did your father ever find out?
No, not really. My father knew that, I don't think they had any idea. I never told him what I meant by abuse. In fact, my mother just really understood that just recently. So I think he knew that maybe, might have thought he may have slapped me once, but he had no idea what I had gone through. Right till he died, he didn't know.
You have a son who you've raised as a single mother.
Correct.
Was it particularly hard being a single mother after growing up with such like a strong male role model in the house as your father, Jackie Robinson?
Actually, it wasn't hard. I'm not saying it's an easy thing, but I have a wonderful relationship with my son, which I've had from the very beginning. And I had so many lessons to learn. I had strong parenting, so I knew how to be a good parent. My son and I have worked through, we did have a crisis in adolescence, you know, and he was trying to figure out who he was and his relationship with his father. But we seem to have an open relationship where we can talk about things, which is, I think, something that's very vital when you're raising your children.
Now, you're a nurse midwife.
Correct.
Your mother worked. How old were you when your mother started working?
Well, I was 10 when she went back to graduate school, and about 12 when she actually started her career.
Did she become a role model for you in showing that, you know, a woman could work and be a good mother at the same time?
Well, in a way not. At that time, it was women were really criticized for going back into going into the workforce.
Mm-hmm.
And my father had a lot of trouble with my mother entering the workforce. It wasn't just that she worked into the workforce. I mean, she's really had a career. So what she, we kind of, both of us rebelled against her working at that point in our lives. We had had her at home for 10, 12 years. So it was a hard transition for us. So initially I felt like I didn't want to be like my mother. I didn't want to have a career. I wanted to be a housewife and have children and be at home. And then when the reality hit that I became a nurse and then I had my child and I was a single parent, I wanted very much to stay at home with my child, and I did stay home for the first year. My mother helped make that possible. However, it was my mother who also said to me, you know, go back to work now while your child is young, because then he'll grow up knowing that it's okay for his mother to work. And you won't have that transition that I had, you know, when I, you know, stayed home with you the first 10, 12 years. And actually, I think she was very much correct. And she did help me at that point understand that I could be both have a career and be a good mother.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not an easy balance. And I struggled with that. What I found I had to do was I had to change my work schedule so that I had more time at home.
Sounds like very interesting advice that she gave you.
I think so.
Your younger brother, David, your surviving brother, is in Tanzania. And you end your book by saying that you applaud his vision and determination living in Africa, but that you see it as a testament to his alienation from America.
I agree. I do feel that way. I mean, my brother and I talk about this a lot. He's comfortable in Africa where he wasn't comfortable in the United States. And I think it's the frustration he felt as with the limitations of being black in this society. And it's the same statement my father made at the end of his book where he talked about, you know, having achieved all these material things and fame, and yet he still realized he was a black man in this society. So I believe this strongly. I felt it even raising my son, that being judged on a surface because you're a black male and having teachers say that they're intimidated by you because your son is a black male. And it's a reality in this society.
Does your brother agree with you in that analysis?
I think on some levels he agrees with me that there is a degree of alienation and that he has made a strong life for himself in Africa. What he doesn't agree with is that I also felt it was somewhat of an escape not to have to really deal with being Jackie Robinson's son by living in a community where he could be, you know, like a king, and that he's like top in that in his community. And I think that has helped him to feel really good about himself.
Has that been an issue for you, getting out of the shadow of your father?
It wasn't so much getting out of the shadow of my father as it was defining who I was.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, it was an issue. When I went off to college, I purposely didn't tell people who my father was. You know, I had to establish who Sharon Robinson was before I could be Jackie Robinson's daughter. And I did that. I mean, I got scholarships. I was married. I had a different last name. I was at Howard University, and I gained respect there for who I was. And then I introduced my father. So at that point, it was all right because I knew who I was.
Sharon Robinson, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry. It's been a pleasure.
Sharon Robinson's new memoir is called Stealing Home. Coming up, a rap record from Africa. This is Fresh Air. Music critic Milo Miles says he's heard what he believes is the first completely effective African rap record, and it brings back some virtues of old-fashioned rap, such as concern for community and the sheer excitement of pioneering a new style.
I was quite skeptical when I approached Salam, the debut album from Positive Black Soul of Senegal. For years, rap has been no more than a gimmick on African records. Plus, it seemed to me that France's MC Solar, the best non-English rapper, was strictly for rap specialists, and the two guys in Positive Black Soul are Solar's protégés. But well, every track on Salam kicks in with a hook or a pulse or a mood that holds your ear. It's another fascinating contribution to the 1996 boomlet in rap.
Sans foi, ni loi, oppose son âme, Salam, la guerre du Vietnam, Saddam. loi du plus fêlé. Je crois que certaines âmes ont besoin de se remettre à l'heure. Après cela, interrogeons-moi toutes les erreurs. Pourquoi je connais.
Many international rappers like Dougie T. Berry and DJ Awadi benefit from the rise of more reflective dance styles like acid jazz and trip-hop. They don't have to compete with American acts to be so slammin'. And the softer cadences of languages like French and Senegalese Wolof can cut through the lighter beats. The music can foster a more reflective tone, as in the Examination of Anxiety we just heard. On the other hand, one of the rowdier tracks on Salam is this next one, which celebrates the pleasures of tea time.
Nous étions quelques positifs chillant sur le balcon d'Aziz. L'atmosphère est sympathique tandis que la musique harmonise une brise. Nous frise mais il nous manque quelque chose. La dose, mais rapidement Eric nous propose.
On tape les beignets, un chien improvisé. En faire une partie de tes idées est approuvée. Si ça boulait la monnaie, tout le monde va cotiser. Sinon, t'as que ce bire là, ça te passe.
Waouh, waouh, que tu spagnes, y'a Dieu pas. Y'a pas de teranga. Dans le poids, si ce n'est pas ça, mais j'ai certains télé. Dans la wakan, moi, attire.
En tout cas, ce n'est pas moi.
Maintenant, mes diables, pour moi, mais avec Eric, ça ira.
Après même discussion. Et beaucoup de protestations. Pour Bac, c'est ok, il est nommé gérant de la station. Le matos s'est lavé, le courant est ambiancé. Le fourneau a avancé, donc le tien peut commencer.
Ataya, 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 Ataya.
Salam includes smart reggae samples, as well as one from England's great lost disco group, Imagination. Traditional string instruments and folk chants sit comfortably next to electronic percussion. Dougie T and DJ Awadi are at home in the rap idiom, and contradict themselves in provocative ways as they command you to respect yourself 1 minute and suspect yourself the next. African identity caught between the tribe and the television is their grand theme, nowhere better addressed than in The Executioner is Black. Because the sound itself is unobtrusive and stark, this number requires you to read along with the translation. Positive Black Soul run through a very vivid and concrete description of disillusionment with corrupt government and false democracy. It's harrowing, mesmerizing, and only smart rappers with a future could have done it.
Milo Miles is a writer living in Cambridge, Massachusetts. He reviewed Salam by Positive Black Soul. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our program is produced this week by Fred Landerl. Our engineers are Richard Parker, Audrey Bentham, Joyce Lieberman, and Dan Lachlan. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Voici quelque temps tu parlais d'enrichissement et liquide. Ça fait déjà des années, mais dis-moi où en est la suite. J'étais fier de toi en ce temps-là, je voyais de la justice. Mais malheureusement, on a tout stoppé et brouillé les pistes. C'est délicat de s'attaquer à certains hommes ou bien leurs fils. Tu veux juger la dynastie, t'es utopiste, mais tu te tiens à coups de millions. La corruption, la religion, beaucoup de gens l'ont bien compris, mais ils évitent la solution. Toucher les religieux, tu sais c'est dangereux. C'est comme pour certaines familles, tu vois ça c'est malheureux. Démocratie, démocratie, quelle belle connerie. En Afrique on vit toujours à l'heure de l'ironie. Les mêmes dominants, les mêmes dominés. Les dominés, les fils de dominants. Dominés, dominés, les dominés. Et année en année, les fils de dominés sont dominés, sont devenus.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.